Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is our Sunday recap of the world of politics from Washington to Springfield with a little pit stop at the fifth floor of City Hall. Thanks for joining me this Sunday morning. Hopefully, it'll be a brighter day than yesterday. Busy Sunday. The Bears are playing at home today. Who knows which Bears team is going to show up to play the Dolphins, but the Bears are on TV today. Of course, my Blackhawks played last night at home against the Preds from Nashville. Jonathan Toews, what can you say? The captain comes through again about 3.5 minutes into overtime with a breakaway shorthanded goal. I mean, they're very, very special. That's my Blackhawks. They're still without a loss in regulation, which is nice, and let's hope they can start picking things up. A little bit depressing, they score early in the game in the first period and then wait until 3 minutes into overtime to get the winner. So let's go Hawks. Let's go Hawks.
That just keeps it interesting.
It does. And I'm okay with, like, you know, long scoreless hockey games. I mean, you know, the other night against Calgary – that's a game we should have won, but it was a goalie victory. Their goalie stopped like 50 shots or 49 of 50 shots. I mean, some days the goalie's hot. There's nothing you can do, even with a team like Calgary that isn't going to go anywhere. Of course, you know, if you're in Calgary, where are you going to go anyway? I mean, but a good victory last night. Obviously, Dave Schwann is back from running the marathon last week.
And he looked good in those short shorts, didn't he?
Oh,
in those
here we
black
go.
Socks.
I knew.
Mary, people are getting pictures up and having breakfast right now. Don't.
Well, it wouldn't have been so bad if he hadn't hiked him up way past his belly button, I'll tell you.
I hope there are no pictures.
Oh, so does everybody. Trust me.
I'm sure Dino caught you sprinting by the window there on Michigan Avenue.
I do have a question, though, since I legitimately was not in the city at this time last week. Was he outside giving away donuts after the marathon?
No, but he had his usual rant, which, I mean.
Oh, right. Mary kept me posted on it. Mary kept me informed.
Well, and it was kind of ridiculous. And, of course, it was like, you know, I encourage guests for the show to come in studio. But it was very difficult to do that last Sunday to try to navigate. I even had my buddy Bernie Schoenberg from the Springfield newspaper, and he was staying over at the Hotel Allegro. And I think he had to walk like all the way north to Ohio and cut back because of that.
Sure.
So,
oh, yeah.
And, of course, I don't know. Did they get the barge out of the river, the barge
Not
that
yet.
Sank?
Not no. yet. They're still working on that. It's a feat of engineering, I might add. But they're still working on that barge.
So my friends over at Wendella are having another day off probably because
you can't get around it.
Yeah, you can't move on it. It's a good Sunday, a good football Sunday, a good day to cook. I'm going to make a little bit of Cajun chicken Big Mamou, which I'll let you know how that turns out before I give you the recipe. But basically, it's Cajun spaghetti with chicken.
Right.
Ooh, that
saying.
Sounds delicious.
It's an old Paul Prudhomme recipe. And it's got your, you know, triumvirate of black, red, and white pepper in it.
A triumvirate.
Yes,
no,
a triumvirate.
A triumvirate of peppers.
And, and it just kind of sits and simmers in the pot. And the great thing about this, and, you know, actually the weather is supposed to be nicer. I normally make this in winter because the great thing is the longer it sits for leftovers, each day it notches up about times two in heat. So it's the perfect
always better.
Perfect
second or third time around.
Perfect sign is clearer. That's what it is. You know, No sense eating Cajun if you don't break a sweat a little bit.
At Paul Prudhomme, that restaurant is just incredible down there.
And I was lucky enough to be there.
That's what you said.
Many years ago when the Republicans had their convention in New Orleans. And I had his cookbook. And the waiter came to the table. And he had, of course, had copies of the cookbook and said, you know, would you like to buy a copy? And I said, you know, I have one already. But if the chef is here and we'll autograph it, I'll buy another one. And so he walks away and he comes back and he says, the chef would like to see you in the kitchen. I said, wow. So I go back to the kitchen and he says, now, I understand you cook out of my cookbook. And I said, yes. And he goes, and you're from Chicago? And I said, yes. He goes, Yankee, put on an apron and make me some roux.
Oh, man.
So I
lucky you.
I put on an apron and gather everything I need to make roux, and then I said the fundamental question. I said, "Do you want what color roux do you want?" And he says, "That's a damn good question."
Yeah, you impressed.
He knew what I was talking about, and served him up some roux for some gumbo. So,
and what color was it?
It was the chocolate brown.
Chocolate brown roux.
Which is the worst kind, because I got to tell you, because, I mean, if you don't know what roux is, it's basically oil and flour. And to get it brown, you are just constantly stirring it so it doesn't burn. But what you're also doing is you're making molten lava. I mean, if it spills out and it touches you, you're going to get a third-degree burn. I mean,
is it that hot?
It is that hot.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's that steaming hot stuff. But it's what you need for a good, you know, a good Cajun meal is some dark chocolate brown roux.
Okay, time for breakfast.
I know. I'm thinking the same thing. Brian needs to get on the stick and start getting breakfast for the show here. I know Kevin Powell does it for Steve
Kevin
Cochran.
Kevin does it for Steve. That's right.
Yeah, what do we get here? I have to bring the donuts in all the time.
I brought in muffins.
Well, okay, that's fine. But I'm trying to do my part.
I'm still working on the kitchen utensils in here, though.
The kitchen utensils?
Well, you know, the
plasticware.
Yeah.
Well, just don't microwave those, okay? just a tip.
Boy, I think, it's a year has gone by now since I set the microwave on fire?
Never to be forgotten.
Never to be forgotten.
I think I might have even talked about it last week while you were gone.
Probably did.
Yes, I'm sure I did. Oh, well. Well, Dave's back on the beat, and I'm glad he's all healed up from the marathon. And Mary's got her eye on the cars this morning. Producer Brian, since he's not getting breakfast, is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. By the way, that's also our text line. And you can also join the discussion on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word. And also on Twitter, @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is pushing all the buttons to keep us on the air on the Mighty 720 this morning. And we've got a lot to talk about in the world of politics as we move to just over 2 weeks from Election Day. Early voting starts tomorrow. Also, you can read our governor candidate profiles, Pat Quinn, Bruce Rauner. You can read those profiles in your Sunday edition of the Chicago Tribune. So grab a cup of coffee while you're listening and reading the Tribune. And coming up, we'll go through last week's governor's debate with the third and final debate scheduled for tomorrow night. My friend and colleague Hal Dardick of the Chicago Tribune will be here. We'll talk about the altered landscape of the upcoming mayor's race, as well as Mayor Emanuel's proposed budget. That'll be coming up after the 8 o'clock news. And then after the 8:30 news, Bob Kastner, a University of Illinois economist and part of the school's Institute of Government and Public Affairs, will join us about his study on the effects of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, in Illinois. Now, that's all coming up. But first, it's time to go through our weekly spin in national politics. And as much as I wanted to avoid it, we really can't be spin-free about how much the political discussion has been focusing on Ebola. Now, you may think this is a recent political topic because of the events in Dallas, but actually, in the Arkansas U.S. Senate race, incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Pryor ran an ad against his challenger, Republican Congressman Tom Cotton, back in August. Take a listen.
I'm Mark Pryor, and I approve this message. The Ebola outbreak is worse
as
than
the
anybody.
Outbreak is, quote, vastly underestimated.
Tom Cotton voted against preparing America for pandemics like Ebola.
Congressman Cotton voted to cut billions from our nation's medical disaster and emergency programs.
He was the only Arkansas congressman to vote this way.
Just like he was the only one to vote against Children's Hospital.
Instead, Cotton voted for tax cuts for billionaires funding his campaign.
Rather than protecting our families.
All right, so that was back in August. So the other day, a reporter from MSNBC caught up with the Democratic Arkansas senator and asked Mark Pryor if he thought the Obama administration was doing enough about Ebola.
I would say that it's hard to know because I haven't heard the latest briefing on that. I mean, I read the paper and all, but my impression is that we have people over there, both from CDC and other medical-type people, and even some engineers to try to build, medical facilities. That's what they need over there. They need the medical infrastructure.
Okay, so you're going to beat up your Republican opponent, but when you're asked if your own Democratic administration's doing enough, the answer is, Anyway, the president has been on the defensive, and he's reportedly very dissatisfied that U.S. government health officials haven't been on top of the issue. Obama appointed Ron Klain, who was Joe Biden's chief of staff, as the new Ebola czar to coordinate the government's response. But amid calls to stop allowing flights from West Africa into the U.S., calls that likely will soon be coming from Democratic U.S. senators as well, the president says he's got his reasons.
We're working quickly to track and monitor anyone who may have been in close contact with someone showing symptoms. We're sharing lessons learned so other hospitals don't repeat the mistakes that happened in Dallas. The CDC's new Ebola rapid response teams will deploy quickly to help hospitals implement the right protocol. All new screening measures are now in place at airports that receive nearly all passengers arriving from Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. And we'll continue to constantly review our measures and update them as needed to make sure we're doing everything we can to keep Americans safe. Finally, we can't just cut ourselves off from West Africa, where this disease is raging. Our medical experts tell us that the best way to stop this disease is to stop it at its source, before it spreads even wider and becomes even more difficult to contain. Trying to seal off an entire region of the world, if that were even possible, could actually make the situation worse. It would make it harder to move healthcare workers and supplies back and forth. Experience shows that it could also cause people in the affected region to change their travel, to evade screening, and make the disease even harder to track.
Now, the president returns home to Chicago this evening, where he'll be headlining a rally for Democratic Governor Pat Quinn at Chicago State University. He'll be spending the night in Chicago, and he's got a fundraiser for the Democratic National Committee on Monday. It's the only political activity he has scheduled for the week outside of Washington. Meanwhile, back on the campaign trail, we've talked about the Texas governor's race between Republican Greg Abbott and Democrat Wendy Davis. Polls are showing Abbott, the attorney general of Texas, opening a lead over Davis. Now, Abbott is wheelchair-bound, the results of being struck by a tree while he was out jogging. Wendy Davis, in one of the most controversial ads airing in these midterm elections, makes a point about that. Here's her ad.
A tree fell on Greg Abbott. He sued and got millions. Since then, he spent his career working against other victims. Abbott argued a woman whose leg was amputated was not disabled because she had an artificial limb. He ruled against a rape victim who sued a corporation for failing to do a background check on a sexual predator. He sided with a hospital that failed to stop a dangerous surgeon who paralyzed patients. Greg Abbott, he's not for you.
Very controversial ad. Some people are calling it basically a Hail Mary ad for Wendy Davis as she faces a very steep climb to try to defeat the Republican in obviously red state Texas. In Virginia, an ad that kind of bucks the trend of partisanship, retired Republican Senator John Warner endorses Democratic Senator Mark Warner. Now, yeah, they have the same last name, but they're no relation. But what's kind of interesting here is that Mark Warner, the Democrat, ran against John Warner, the Republican, and lost in 1996. Here's that ad.
For 30 years, it was my privilege to represent you in the United States Senate. In Congress, to get things done, You got to have the guts to cross the aisle and reach bipartisan agreement. That's what I did. That's what Mark Warner does today. While we come from different parties, we both believe in putting Virginia first. I know Mark Warner. He's decisive, experienced, and has courage. He earned my vote. Your vote is equally important.
I'm Mark Warner, and I'm honored to approve this message.
Now, we've also talked about the race in Kentucky, where Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is being challenged by Democrat Allison Lundergan Grimes. Some bad news for her, though. National Democrats have pulled their ads for her, and progressive groups aren't happy with her over this ad.
Ads attacking Allison Lundergan Grimes on immigration have been called false, bizarre, and hypocritical. Only Mitch McConnell has voted to give amnesty and taxpayer-funded benefits to 3 million illegal aliens, the largest legalization program in U.S. history. Mitch is at the heart of everything that's wrong in Washington, from hypocrisy to greed to gridlock.
I'm Allison Lundergan Grimes, and I approve this message because I've never supported amnesty or benefits for illegal immigrants, and I never will.
Amnesty, illegal immigrants, not exactly catchphrases for Democratic progressives, and that may seal the fate of Allison Lundergan Grimes. Now, of course, our spin couldn't be complete without one of the weirdest beginnings of a political debate ever in history. Former Florida Governor Charlie Crist, he's a Democrat, was a Republican governor, turned Democrat. He wants his old job back. He took the stage at Broward College, but Florida Governor Rick Scott wouldn't come out. Here's the moderator trying to explain what's going on.
Florida Governor Rick Scott, our incumbent governor and the Republican candidate for governor, is also in the building. Governor Rick Scott, we have been told that Governor Scott will not be participating in this debate. Now, let me explain what this is all about. Governor Crist has asked to have a fan, a small fan, placed underneath his podium. The rules of the debate that I was shown by the Scott campaign say that there should be no fan. Somehow there is a fan there, and for that reason, ladies and gentlemen, I am being told that Governor Scott will not join us for this debate.
So the rules of the debate were that you could not have any electronic devices behind your lectern. And, obviously, so you couldn't, like, have an earpiece or something to catch signals from a staff member. The Scott campaign took that to mean you can't have a fan blowing on you. Governor Scott did come out after 6 minutes, and they did engage their debate, but it left a very bad taste in the minds of a lot of Floridians over something as trivial as whether a fan can really decide the fate of who becomes Florida's next governor. Well, when we come back, we're going to take another look at a debate, an interesting 7-way debate for Vermont governor. And, of course, Vermont is another planet. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson here with your Sunday Spin, your weekly political briefing. We're talking a bit about debates this morning. We had the weird opening to the one in Florida over Charlie Crist's floor fan. Well, in Vermont, which, as I say, is often on another planet, they recently held their debate featuring 7 candidates for governor. There were long beards, jorts, a few suits, sequins and a big hat, and a discussion of highway restrooms as Democratic Governor Pete Shumlin seeks re-election.
I am a revolutionary nonviolent socialist.
I consider myself what is known as a light worker. And why I'm in the race is to bring forth the very exciting solutions.
My name is Scott Milne. I've third generation, born in Vermont. Take that back. I was born in Brooklyn.
Second of all, I would reinstate all the rest areas on the state highway that Peter Shumlin has removed.
You know, we've actually been adding rest area facilities. We built a new one in Bennington. I cut the ribbon on that.
You've taken them out in 91 and 89.
I can assure you that there have been no rest areas removed under my governorship.
We have to stop
the military. Zero military budget. Close all the bases. Stop the factories that build all that equipment and ship it off to the Zionist regime so that it can defend itself against the gigantic Gazan military.
The question was about reforming the Department for Children and Families, Mr. Peters.
Just hilarious. I mean, I especially think a great bumper sticker is, I can assure you no highway rest areas were removed under my governorship. I think that's a great bumper sticker that every governor wants to have. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about the last governor's debate here in Illinois, and as well as looking ahead to tomorrow night's third and final debate. Right now, though, it's 7:30. Time for the news. Here's Dave Schwann.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
7:37 in the morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. 312-981-7200 is our phone number here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Just a couple of things you might want to put on your calendar. I mentioned, you know, tomorrow is the start of early voting, if you want to take advantage of that. A couple of things going on in the city. On November 1st, my friends over at the South Loop Neighbors have their annual loft walk, which is actually a great opportunity to kind of see some buildings that you normally don't get to see down in the South Loop, go along the old historic motor row and that kind of thing. Actually, a great opportunity. You can go to southloopneighbors.org for more information on that. And also on Sunday, November 2nd, which, of course, 2 days before the election, I can't be there, but I'd encourage you all to go. It's my friends at the Literacy Volunteers from Illinois are having their Scrabble for Literacy Challenge. It's a lot of fun. They actually have like a real competitive for, I almost want to say professional Scrabble players, but like a real competition there for playing Scrabble. And also there's just for fun, there's games and everything like that. And that's over at Grossinger's Honda at 6600 Northwestern Avenue. That's Sunday, November 2nd from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. And you can go to LVIllinois.org. And you can get more details on that. But that's my good friends who help promote literacy and, as we talked about last week, news literacy, which is a fundamental, I think, thing if you want to get involved in understanding politics. And it's very important. And speaking of news literacy, I don't like to talk about another newspaper. I mean, sure, I've got my bias. I work for the Tribune. I respect the people I work with and work for. I respect the higher standards, I think, that we bring to our news than other news organizations. There's an interesting story that surfaced in Cranes yesterday involving politics and the news. And this is an example, I think, of what you call about bad optics, okay? So you've probably seen these ads that the Pat Quinn campaign has been running, raising allegations that there was a lawsuit involving Bruce Rauner's equity firm GTCR. And in the complaint, a woman CEO alleged certain things that she felt she was being bullied by Mr. Rauner. When it went to trial, she was asked about, you know, the conversation she had with Bruce Rauner, and was asked, you know, she said it was businesslike. Nothing came up about the bullying, the allegations, those kinds of things. I mean, that's one reason when the Tribune looked at this that we didn't really see a story here. The Sun-Times did a story, and Channel 5 did a story. They have their news judgment, you know, that's their decision. But what's come to light in this Crane story is that just hours before it went to press in the Sun-Times, the Rauner campaign tried to quash the story, calling the Sun-Times and noting that Dave McKinney, the longtime State House bureau chief there, was recently married to Ann Liston, who is a longtime Democratic consultant. And the Rauner campaign is alleging that she had something to do with this story or promoting the story. The Sun-Times says that they're well aware of Ann Liston's history, that she and Dave McKinney have satisfied to their best ability a separation there, that she's not involved in any campaigns in Illinois. And, you know, I've known Dave a long time. He's written pieces on both sides. He's written pieces about Quinn and that anti-violence NRI program. He's written pieces about Rauner. I'm not going to speak to the news judgment of that story there. But anyway, McKinney, Dave kind of disappeared off the radar screen for about a week, which is very unusual, 3 weeks out of a campaign for governor. The Sun-Times says there was no disciplinary action taken, anything like that. The Rauner campaign says that McKinney's relationship should be disclosed because cites something from the Society of Professional Journalists. And no offense to SPJ, I'm sure they're a great group, but I'm kind of the Groucho Marx world, that I never want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member. And for a campaign to talk about journalistic standards, let's look at what these campaigns are doing and what standards do they actually have. So, to me, I guess the bottom line is everyone in life needs a good editor, with the emphasis on good. And as for the Rauner campaign, you know, if you want to be a journalist, go buy a newspaper. Oh, wait, that's right. Rauner was a part owner of the Chicago Sun-Times and sold his 10% interest in the paper before he ran for governor. But interestingly enough, if you open up the Sun-Times today, you'll see that the Sun-Times has resumed, after a lengthy hiatus, they've resumed endorsing candidates, even though they haven't interviewed any of them. Who'd they endorse for governor? Bruce Rauner. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Come and join the conversation. And actually, we've got a call from Mike. Mike, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Good morning.
Sure, good morning.
One thing I disagree with you on is I think it's just the opposite of what you said. When it comes to the Chicago Tribune, I have more faith in the integrity and impartiality and professionalism of the writers than I do the editorial board.
Well, it's two separate things. I mean, the editorial board is its own function. They're there to opine, to express their opinion, to express their reasoning. As a reporter, and the news side of the paper is a completely separate function. I mean, as reporters, we don't have anything to do with editorial board endorsements or opinions. Our job is simply to report the news. And truly, as much as it may be hard to believe, there is very much a wall that exists between the editorial board and the editorial pages and the people that work there versus those of us that work on the news side. So, I mean, it's two different animals. Their job, they're charged with coming up with offering their reasoning on things. Our side on the news side is to do the news.
My problem with the editorial board of the Tribune is, in the past, they've written editorials that were very unflattering and untrue about city employees. I happen to be one. And when I gave them the facts and the contracts, they tried to say that in certain aspects, private contractors were less expensive than us. When I proved it true, they got snippy and they said, well, those are the facts we have. I says, well, here's the actual contracts the city paid out, and it proves it untrue. They didn't want to print a retraction.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you for offering that. I appreciate it. And, you know, again, I'd encourage you to even write a letter to the editor, which is really what I kind of encourage everybody to do. And I know that they are pretty diligent about trying to get counter viewpoints presented, at least through the letters to the editor. I've been talking about debates this morning. Tomorrow night is the last debate between the candidates for governor, Bruce Rauner and Pat Quinn. They had their second debate last week. And kind of an interesting, a little bit feistier kind of atmosphere. And in fact, it was kind of interesting, the fact that this was held at the DuSable Museum of African American History. So it was kind of geared as the candidates kind of addressing issues of concern to African Americans. But if you take it at the broader sense, I mean, all our concerns are really the same. Kind of interesting how Bruce Rauner started out basically saying that Pat Quinn, Democrats here in blue state Illinois, are taking the African-American vote for granted.
Governor Quinn, in my opinion, is taking the African-American vote for granted. I will deliver real results for African-American families. African-American families are suffering in Illinois, brutally high unemployment, deteriorating schools, lack of a proper social services, and rampant cronyism and corruption that's taking away job opportunities from African Americans. We have goals for African American contracting opportunities in this state. We are nowhere near meeting those goals that the state has set out. And Pat Quinn was taking, because he's taken the vote for granted, he threw Stephanie Neely off his ticket and didn't bring her in as his lieutenant governor when he could have and should have.
Kind of interesting there, Stephanie Neely, the city treasurer, African-American woman, who was in the short list of Pat Quinn's picks for a running mate, and obviously he selected Paul Vallis. Quinn, for his part, defended his diversity in his cabinet, African-Americans in his administration, while he also took a shot at Bruce Rauner and promoted Obama.
Crystal Thomas is the deputy governor. She's led our effort to enroll almost 700,000 people in the Affordable Care Act. That's what we've done in Illinois. My opponent is opposed to the Affordable Care Act. He said we shouldn't support the president, President Obama, in his campaign to get that done and send us money. But we've helped hundreds of thousands of people get health coverage, many of them for the first time in their life.
Now, Bruce Rauner was forced to try to defend himself on his bungling of the minimum wage issue. Back in the Republican primary, he had said he was actually in favor of rolling back the state's $8.25 an hour minimum wage to the federal rate, which is a dollar less. He said in a radio interview back in the primary that he had advocated eliminating a minimum wage. And then under criticism from his Republican rivals for the GOP nomination, said he was for an increase in the minimum wage if it was done across the country so that Illinois wouldn't be at a competitive disadvantage, or he'd be for an increase in Illinois accompanied by the right pro-business kind of reforms. Here's his explanation.
The minimum wage is a very important issue, but what we need to focus on is maximum income, maximum opportunity for every family. The real policies we need in place is not just to raise the minimum wage, which I support, but it's more important that we create an economic opportunity so families can rise beyond the minimum wage, be all they can be, not just hope to get a job, hope to get to the minimum wage. What I'll do is push to raise the national minimum wage, which is a good policy that will make Illinois competitive on a level playing field with all the other states, because today Illinois has a higher minimum wage, and that's hurting employment here. But I also will support raising Illinois' minimum wage, but I want to do it along with pro-business reforms, workers' comp reform, tax reduction, and tort reform, so that small businesses can afford to pay a higher minimum wage and we won't push up our unemployment problems that are already too high.
Well, the governor says that he's for a minimum wage hike without qualification before the year's end.
Governor, your chance.
Well,
to
we're
going
to raise the minimum wage, no conditions. We're going to make sure it's done by the end of this year. I've already worked on it in 2003 and 2007 when we raised the minimum wage before. There's a principle as old as the Bible. If you work hard, you shouldn't have to live in poverty. And my opponent, over and over again, with a $63 million income last year, was going around Illinois telling people to eliminate the minimum wage. He's adamantly against the minimum wage. Don't listen to this loose talk we've heard tonight. There's only one person running for governor who favors raising the minimum wage, and that's me.
We're playing a few snippets from the last debate in anticipation of tomorrow night's final debate between Pat Quinn and Bruce Rauner. I'm Rick Pearson. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. We're almost at 10 minutes past 8 here on the kind of a chilly Sunday morning. It's nice downtown, but Hal Dardick, my buddy from the Tribune, coming in from the suburbs, says it's like 35 degrees at O'Hare and woke up to a hard frost. And,
it was chilly out there this morning.
Rude awakening.
But it's very nice here out. I was just out on the WGN Storm Center patio where the sun is shining and seeing that Michigan Avenue south of the river is closed right now because I guess they're filming some kind of movie. I knew there was sporadic.
I think Mary said a low-flying helicopter scene or something like that. Is that what's going on?
Yes. It's called Puck Productions, and the movie is called Mineral.
Okay.
So if you see a low-flying helicopter in the downtown area,
that's why.
Don't dismay.
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. They're filming a movie.
Don't wave at it, because that'll look bad, you know, when they do the production. So just ignore it.
Yes.
Everything is fine. But yeah, so just be aware of those kinds of goofy things. Not as goofy as last week with the marathon when it was going to be the Mary DeBadges show to explain all of the road closures for 2 hours. But fortunately, we're somewhat back to normal here in downtown Chicago. And you didn't have any problems getting in here, Hal, did you?
No, it was quite quick. I managed to avoid that sunken barge.
that's another thing, too. Well, I've got Hal in. Hal's part of our political team at the Tribune. Hal covers City Hall and does a great job. And it's been a very interesting week when it comes to the Hall. Politics, policy. You know, we start the week with the announcement that Karen Lewis, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union, has a cancerous brain tumor undergoing treatment. But obviously, that takes her out of the mayoral race. And quite frankly, you know, the week before when no one was saying what her illness was, you could kind of tell that the mayoral race, that as far as she was concerned, that wasn't going to happen.
Everyone was assuming, even before we learned that she had a cancerous brain tumor, that she would not be in the race because they weren't saying anything about it. We knew they said it was a serious illness. So and she'd been in the hospital for several days, which is unusual, as we all know in today's world. They don't keep you in the hospital that long unless there's something really wrong. And so we knew that her campaign folks said they were going to continue collecting petitions, but at the same time, we were just sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop, and then she made a formal announcement, I think it was Monday, that she would not be running in the contest, which really changed the entire landscape. Because at this point, we have Alderman Bob Fioretti running. He's the other well-known contender in the race. But we thought that Karen Lewis was the one that was going to be able to debate the mayor with the greatest authority because she'd sort of changed the dialogue here in the city of Chicago in terms of this mayor. And she also perhaps had the most ability to raise a lot of money and give him a real challenge. It was going to be a real interesting race, we all thought, if she got into it. And now that she's out of it, you have Bob Fioretti, who's having a real hard time raising any significant amount of money, who just, you know, he's been an alderman for about 8 years, and people don't necessarily know alderman unless that's their alderman, and he at this point is only polling. Last time we did a poll at the Tribune, about I think it was 25%. So is it a cakewalk for the mayor, who's got nearly $9 million in the bank and another $2 million and something in another fund? Well, it's not his money, but it's a super PAC that is going to advocate on his behalf, or perhaps against aldermen that have opposed his agenda. So is it just another case like some of the daily contests where he's just going to walk right through and not really have to worry very much? It'll be real interesting to see how he handles himself, because in recent months he had started tilting toward the left on the issue of minimum wage, on the issue of housing, single-room occupancy hotels that he was protecting for folks who are poor and maybe have some issues and couldn't afford to live anywhere else. Will he start tacking a little bit more towards the center as he had before that? We got a completely different landscape. And frankly, for us reporters, it won't be quite as fascinating, we don't think.
Or entertaining, I guess. I would say.
Yes.
That's my colleague Hal Dardick from the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. We're here in the Allstate Showcase Studio, 312 312- 981-7200 is your phone number. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Almost 20 after 8 here on a beautiful Sunday morning in the city of Chicago. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio with my good friend Hal Dardick from the Tribune's political team who covered City Hall. We're talking about the changed landscape, changed dynamic in the mayoral race. Karen Lewis, serious illness, actually dropping out of a race before it even started. As you mentioned, Bob Fioretti, the second ward alderman, kind of the most viable, I guess, candidate. Does Fioretti bring, can he get the disaffected people that kind of were supporting Karen Lewis, can he get them as does he present himself as a logical alternative?
Oh, I think indeed, right after Karen formally announced that she was out of the race, Bob sent out an email and he said, you know, I'm in this race, and Karen represented a certain constituency, and I hope to attract some of those voters. That's not the exact wording, but that was the essence of the email.
Well, he used the term movement.
Yes.
And truly, I kind of think, you know, Karen Lewis did have a kind of a movement following. And certainly it was obviously rooted through the Chicago Teachers Union, which she's the head of, but was building out that kind of thing. And I think one of the things that some people that supported her found important was African-American and female. And obviously with Bob Fioretti, you're not getting that, but he does have some support in parts of the African-American community.
Yeah, in fact, when he was first elected to the second ward 8 years ago, it was a predominantly African-American ward. And so he appealed to that constituency in certain ways. The issues that he represented, he was more to the progressive side of the Democratic spectrum. He has been out over the past 8 years, off and on, in Southside neighborhoods across the city, trying to get his message across. So he does have some appeal to that. And he also, there's also a broad spectrum of people across the city who think this mayor is too conservative for them in the way he's closed nearly 50 schools in the Chicago Public Schools.
Which kind of played in there, again, to the Lewis candidacy.
Right, yeah, and she had been his primary opponent on that issue. So there's a number of issues in which they're the same, but I don't think she has this, or he has the same sort of broad appeal that Karen Lewis had, because she had taken him on in the strike, and in a lot of people's minds, she had clearly been the victor in that contest. And here's Rahm Emanuel, who has this reputation as Rambo, and she came in and she says, "I can take this guy on," and she did, you know, and people were impressed with that. Yes,
yes,
yes. He had to scale back some of his desires in that teacher's contract that she was able to get for her membership. I think that the other major factor in this race that Bob Fioretti probably starts with, above all the other candidates that we know less about, like Amira Anyaya, who's, you know, a really bright young African-American woman from Austin neighborhood and has a business background and an activist background, but in some of the other candidates that sort of are perennial runs, if you will, is Bob brings more than that. He can attract the anybody but Rahm.
Vote. Well, and in fact, you know, back when we did our poll on the budding race a month or so ago, and you cited the fact that Fioretti got about, you know, 25% or whatever, that was with virtually nobody knowing who he was. So you already have perhaps a base of 1 in 4 Chicago voters that is not going to support Mayor Emanuel no matter what. So, I mean, there you have a pretty healthy starting point in which to grow from. But, you know, I'm kind of curious, too, as you look at Fioretti, the fact that in the redrawing of the new ward maps was basically carved out of his own ward. And What does that say about him and his relationship to his colleagues on the council?
Bob Fioretti had been, in many ways, with both Mayor Daley and Mayor Emanuel, the alderman know when it came to the mayoral agenda. And he sort of tried to build that reputation. But at the same time, there's a sort of collegial atmosphere that occurs in the city council. And he didn't do much to cultivate that sort of collegial relationship, to build coalitions, to get issues passed. He was out there sort of doing that all on his own. And there were certain progressives that tended to band with him. There's about seven or eight other aldermen that sided with him on those issues because they felt the same way on those issues. But in some of those cases, even the folks that are aligned with the various mayors would get along with the folks who weren't. Bob didn't. He didn't have a lot of friends on
and
the
that's kind of what that's kind of the signal that I took from the mapping, because I mean, if you remember when Illinois remapped its congressional districts, and Congressman Phelps from deep southern Illinois basically got mapped out, and when you ask people, it was because, well, you know, regardless of party, there is a collegiality that exists, and if it's for Illinois, it's everybody's for it. And yet Phelps was not part of that, kind of didn't want to be part of that clique.
Yeah, Bob has tried to portray his being mapped out as because he's such a great opponent to the mayors and he has such a voice that they wanted to silence him. But I think the reality is very much like you're just talking about with Congressman Phelps. What the issue was that if someone had to go in order to create the right amount of African-American and Latino wards, needed to please those blocks of aldermen and also to do it under the U.S. Constitution to give the one man
voting
one
rights,
vote.
Voting Rights Act and things like that.
That some aldermen had to go, some white aldermen. And everybody's like, frankly, people I've talked to who were in on those negotiations said, okay, there goes Bob. Sorry, Bob. You know, and so he didn't, you know, and I'm not making any comment on Bob's personality or, you know, his abilities or anything, but he didn't build a lot of friends, and so they were willing to get rid of him first.
Very quickly here, just to switch gears, we had the mayor presenting his budget, punting on that issue of pensions, the nearly $600 million for police and firefighter pensions, that in hopes that Springfield will do something, which we both know Springfield. But one of the things I was curious about, you know, this kind of a little hodgepodge of different fees and things, the parking, all that kind of stuff. I thought Mayor Emanuel, when he ran, said that he wasn't going to nickel and dime the taxpayers. And that's what, you know, I look at some of this hodgepodge assortment of stuff, you know, that's what it looks like.
Well, he has, and there's a number of those things in this budget, and there have been a number of those things in all four of his budget proposals so far. This time, folks who subscribe to cable TV the cable company's taxes are going to be increased, amusement taxes.
So that'll pass along.
But they'll pass that right along to the people that subscribe to cable TV. If you lease a car, you're going to see your lease tax on that go up by a percentage point. There are a number. There's no increases in fees and fines or property taxes, which he likes to point to. But there's little things that will get you without you knowing. I mean, what he doesn't mention in this budget, because he and the council were politically astute enough to get this done before they entered budget season, is that if you have a telephone, whether it's a landline or a cell phone, and who doesn't these days, and people have multiple lines because of the cell phone era, and you're going to see your tax go up by $1.40 a month. Well, you may not notice that, and that's why they did that,
right?
Because it's not as obvious as the property tax, but they'll probably get just as much out of you, if not more, from that new fee for 911 services on your telephones. So it's a sort of a death by a thousand cuts. Maybe you don't feel all those little cuts, you know.
But we're all going to be bleeding. That's for darn yes. Sure. Hal Dardick, thank you very much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin. I appreciate you getting up and winding your way past the sunken barge on the river.
My pleasure, Rick, always.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin.
on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, everybody. Rick Pearson from the Tribune here with your weekly roundup of the world in politics, the Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. And here joining me in the Allstate Showcase studio is Bob Kastner, a health economics professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And he's part of the University of Illinois' Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And Bob, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I thought this would be fairly timely because, one, we've got the president is coming back home to Chicago this evening. He's going to headline a get-out-the-vote rally for Pat Quinn at 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, which I know is prime time for politics. He has a fundraiser for the Democratic National Committee tomorrow. And frankly, that's the only out-of-state political travel that he's doing this week. Obviously, the Ebola issue is kind of raising public concern, and although he did play golf yesterday, I should point that out. But everybody, you know, deserves a little bit of break. But Bob did a kind of a study of the effect of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, on uninsured people, and a very interesting fact, and certainly Illinois took full advantage of expanded Medicaid eligibility rules. It's reimbursed by the federal government. Not all states did that, but Illinois showed a pretty significant drop in the number of uninsured residents.
Yeah, Illinois did well relative to the rest of the country. Illinois showed a 2.6 percentage point drop in the number of people who are uninsured. That's about 300,000 people. Compared to the rest of the nation, it's about 2.1%. And even in the surrounding states, we've done.
And I think that's a key as compared to the surrounding states.
Yeah, I mean, because we have some good counterpoints to Illinois. Indiana didn't expand Medicaid. Wisconsin did not expand Medicaid. Missouri did not expand Medicaid. So the Affordable Care Act had two components or two big objectives, one to reduce the uninsured, one to hold down health care costs. I think the uninsured was the thing that resonated with people most. So, and to do that, we had to expand Medicaid. That's a program for low-income people. And then we had the healthcare exchanges where employed people or near-poor people could get their health insurance. So by expanding Medicaid, Illinois seemed to have done a better job, where in Indiana and Wisconsin, the percentage of people without health insurance barely changed at all. And so that's a clear difference.
Bob, what is the relationship between insured, increasing the number of insured, to the issue of healthcare costs?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, of course, because when you don't have insurance, you don't go to the doctor as much, so you don't spend as much. And then when you get insurance, you spend more than you otherwise would. So giving people insurance actually increases how much they spend on health care. But a lot of people, although it's not quite clear, think that that's a good early investment, that will save
rather than having to pay for the major
the downstream costs
that when people finally do go see they're going to an emergency room, it's for a serious illness, and obviously the costs magnify.
Right. That's a very strong intuition and logic, where you get people timely care, early care, it helps prevent the later large bills that come through hospitalization. But there's an alternative also. It's, you know, I always use the example. I go to the doctor. I raise my arm. I say, I have a little ache in my arm. The doctor says, really? Maybe you need an X-ray. So I get the X-ray, and he says, oh, well, then you go to the orthopedist. And he says, well, you know, I could do arthroscopic surgery. So by going to the doctor more, sometimes you end up spending
driving more costs.
Yeah, so that's a double-edged sword about it. But I think the everybody, I go to sleep better at night having my insurance, so I think everyone supports having more insured people. But it's not necessarily going to lead to lower costs. Lower costs are the other aspects of the Affordable Care Act, how we pay doctors and provide incentives.
Things like electronic record keeping and all those things that we've heard about for decades, but somehow it's always cutting edge.
Also not to pay doctors to do more or hospitals to do more, to pay doctors and hospitals to keep people healthy instead of just doing more things.
So. And more procedures that are more billable like billable hours kind
of. That's the real key. So
now how do these exchanges work?
Yeah, the exchanges. So again, Illinois had the federal government operated Illinois' exchange.
Right.
So most of the states had the federal government operate their exchanges. So the exchanges are great places. You can go if you don't have health insurance and you're not poor enough to
qualify for Medicaid.
Then you could get health insurance on the exchanges. It's just like an online marketplace. You go online, you put in your name, your number, you register, and then they have a whole range of types of health care plans you could pick from more generous to less generous kind of benefits, more costly to less costly. But if you qualify, if you have income up to 400% of federal poverty level, which is, I think, about $60,000 for an individual. For families, it goes up to like $80,000 or $90,000. You'll be eligible for a federal subsidy. So the federal government will help pay for you. So, again, one of the interesting things about the study I did was Kentucky, which Mitch McConnell, the Republican's home state, who wasn't a great supporter of the Affordable Care Act. But they really invested a lot in their exchange. They had a state-run exchange, not a federal exchange.
Connect, I think, is the name of their...
Yeah, KY Connect.
Yeah.
It's a play on KY Connect. So, but they were... Kentucky had the second largest decrease in uninsured in the country. And a lot of people point to the success of their state exchange. They engaged insurance brokers that sell all the insurance to firms to get people out. So it's a very important way to that the Affordable Care Act has helped decrease the uninsured. Illinois has done over, I think the latest estimate was about 200,000 people signed up in Illinois through the health insurance marketplace. So that's good.
But Kentucky was more aggressive in their outreach kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think people point to the brokers, the special role of these health insurance brokers that really reach out to small businesses, to firms, to salesmen. Illinois invested in what we call navigators to help people sign up who couldn't understand. But and it was somewhat successful. It also depends on the poverty rates of the two states. But I think Kentucky was quite aggressive in its outreach. Yes.
Well, I think it was very interesting the other day, of course, and we've been talking on the show a little bit about Mitch McConnell's reelection and Alison Lundergan Grimes, the Democrat, and they had their debate, and he was asked about, you know, well, you keep saying you want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but look at the success of Kentucky, and he said, well, it was a great website.
Yeah, that could be true. I mean, but a great website that, you know, the great thing about the exchanges is before the exchanges, and I'm not, the institute and the university is nonpartisan and evidence-based.
Right.
But the one really important thing about the exchanges were before, if you didn't have health insurance through your employer and you went to an insurance company to buy insurance, they thought you were sick and they charged you a very high price.
You must have a problem.
Right. So it was really became prohibitively expensive to buy insurance for a lot of people, where on the exchange that doesn't happen.
No, because it becomes almost like a pool kind of system.
So, and that's the point. We have to get the young invincibles, the healthy in there, and to kind of subsidize the sicker people, the older people like myself. But that's an important part of the exchange, and that's why it's clearly the subsidies help too. Everybody likes a subsidy.
Bob Kastner from the University of Illinois Chicago, health economist, joining me here in the Showcase studio, the Allstate Showcase studio. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by Bob Kastner, who is an expert on health economics, economist professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, part of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, which I lean on heavily for help. And we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and what it's done as far as the uninsured. And, you know, Bob, we were talking about how Illinois has somewhat outperformed by the numbers, our Midwest states, and is above, I guess, the national average as far as getting more uninsured people onto the rolls through primarily the expansion of Medicaid. But yet, while that may sound good, you still note there's still plenty of people who are uninsured out there.
Yeah, I mean, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, has got off to a good start, but if we think about before and after the Affordable Care Act, 4 out of every 5 people who were without insurance before are still without insurance. So it's only affected about 20% of the uninsured. So nationally, we used to have about 50 million people uninsured. It's about 40 million now.
Which is still a huge number.
Yeah, and in Illinois, we decreased the number of uninsured by about 300,000 or so, according to the latest numbers that I've used. But we still have a million people without insurance in Illinois. So there's still a lot of work to be done. The ACA is still early on. It's been early on forever, it seems.
Right. But it's a work in progress, yes, right?
It might be for a long time.
Yes. Well, and you know, we noted, you know, and obviously the launch of it was horrible. And you know, you would think in these days of smartphones and those kinds of things. But also, of these uninsured, you know, one of the big concerns was in order to kind of create this kind of universe of people that spreads risk throughout to make healthcare more affordable, required the young people to sign on. Right. What are you finding with
that?
Well,
again, in Illinois, we found a bigger decrease in percentage terms of the uninsured among the young people. So we've seen quite a bit of the young people signing up. And nationally, I think it was a surprise to some people that so many have signed up. But as you said, and without taking my course, that you know, the spreading risk is really important. Again, going to the health insurance, when people who are sick need insurance. People who are healthy have to subsidize it, and then we all rotate in getting sick once in a while. So, but it's really important. But it's been not a disaster as some people predicted, and quite good. I think it's still a work in progress because the penalties for signing up are so low.
Yeah, and I think it was $96 was the penalty, even if it was assessed. I'm not even sure that it was.
Right. I mean, it'll be on their tax returns this year, and there's all hardship cases. So once you open the hardship door, the door gets quite big sometimes. But the penalties will grow over time, and they're an important part of keeping that young group in there because they're not inclined to pay.
Right. Well, the young invincibles, right. As we say, that are going to live forever.
Right. I used to think of that myself as that.
Well, and you know, and truly, too, in some respects, you also have the fact with through the Affordable Care Act, with the younger people up to age 26 being able to still be on their parents' health insurance has also been kind of a factor to close the door somewhat in that
crowd. Yeah, no, a lot of research has shown that has kept a lot of the young people in. There's a real spike in the number of people in the 18 to 26-year-old range that got health insurance, private health insurance, through their parents. And that was clearly a contributor to the increase in the number of insured people among the young. So
now, in going through the numbers, too, you raised an interesting point off-air about surprisingly enough, here in Illinois, in some respects, the numbers don't necessarily add up.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. It's not just specific to Illinois, but it's some evidence nationally. So I think
that was my Illinois cynicism, basically.
Yeah, but it is important. The Department of Health and Family Services here in Illinois has reported that almost 500,000 people have increased the enrollment in Medicaid. The Illinois Covered Health Insurance Exchange in the state reported about 200,000. So I can do the simple math. That's about 700,000 people that have gotten Medicaid or insurance through the exchange. But when I looked at the number of people who have actually gained insurance coverage from not having any,
it was
only about half that size. And so you start thinking, well, where did it come from? Well, a lot of people who got coverage through the exchange, some of them probably had private insurance already through their employer. But now, given that they can get a subsidy, they migrate to the exchange. Same with Medicaid. Some people have – Medicaid is very low cost for the consumer, so they might migrate. And there's a lot of evidence on that from the previous expansions in Medicaid, that somewhere between 25 and 50% of all the new Medicaid enrollees came from privately insured. So I refer to it as a little shuffling of the deck where – although we've increased Medicaid rolls by 500,000 and the private insurance through the exchange by 200,000, it could be up to half of those people already were insured privately through employer or their spouse or other ways. So the net gain is much smaller in terms of how much we've reduced uninsured, but we pay for maybe one or two, for every two people we pay for, only one newly
Is a newly insured person. Yeah. And in some respects, it's the taxpayers that are picking up the burden that would have been the private employer or whatever before.
Right, because, of course, the goal was to be efficient with our tax dollars, to reduce the number of uninsured at the least costly way. Now, I don't know if there's a better way to do it, but when we talk about this crowding out of private insurance or what I call the shuffling of the deck, it definitely increases the cost per person insured, newly insured. So, you know, that's a burden the taxpayers will have to bear. And even though in the state, oh, the other point I would make is the federal government has provided a great deal for states to expand Medicaid, but it's still not free. Even the Department of Health and Family Services, the state's own estimates, spending on Medicaid is going to go up about $500 million this year. So we all know the budget situation, and $500 million is small in the relative terms. But
it's still a lot of money.
Because it's bigger than zero, and we don't have enough right now.
So. Well, and of course, we keep hearing caution from Washington, from the House Republicans, the issue of that subsidy to the states for the Affordable Care Act, and warning that this is not going to last that much longer. And
right,
so
that
creates a budget concern.
So again, for example, the Affordable Care Act made the state of Illinois raise the payments to primary care doctors. And they said, we'll cover it for 2013-14. Illinois did that. 2015 rolls around. It's almost impossible to think that the state's going to cut the payments then, and they're going to be on the hook for them. That's just one example. But in a larger sense, the whole federal subsidy will erode over time, but may go away eventually. And that's the scary part.
A lot to be scared of in Illinois. Bob Kastner, thank you very much for joining me here on the Sunday Spin this morning. We'll be back with more right after this.